Welcome to Secure Talk, a podcast for security news, innovation, and excellence. Secure Talk is hosted by Justin Beals, founder and CEO of StrikeGraph. Justin has a 20-year career in technology, innovation, and startups.
Welcome, everybody, to Secure Talk. Really excited to have you joining us today. I'm Justin Beals, your host, and we have another exceptional guest on the podcast today. We're really privileged to be joined by Alex Cox, the Director of Threat Intelligence for LastPass. Alex, welcome to the podcast today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
I am really curious about threat intelligence. It's something that I know very little about, but we'd love to start with our guests kind of telling their story of especially how they got into their career and their space and their expertise. Our early in career listeners really trying to track a path in cybersecurity are interested in this. So just a brief introduction in yourself. I think you started out with an interest in criminal justice. Is that right, Alex?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I've been in the cyber industry at this point for over 20 years, but initially I went to college for criminal justice and I was a civilian cop right out of school for 3 years or so. And at the same time, I was a reserve officer in the Army and the MP Corps. So very law enforcement focused early part of my career. I did that for a little while and I had a good friend who was kind of interested in computers. And I had I was kind of a computer hobbyist for a very long time at that point. And I was teaching him stuff. And I remember one of my cop buddies came to me and said, I just got a raise and I'm making X amount of dollars. And I went, man, you've been here for like 10 years and you're making that much. It wasn't a whole lot, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Well, so then my friend goes and gets a job who I taught everything he knew about computers, goes and gets a job as a network administrator, making double what I was making as a cop. And I'm like, I taught this guy everything he knows, right? So I started thinking about, a career change at that point and ended up getting a job on a help desk and, getting into the IT space. And one of the things that I did in IT was I managed antivirus, so the antivirus for Wachovia at the time, the bank.
Yeah.
And when I started, playing around with the security stuff, I thought, man, this is really cool. And it's sort of a neat combination of my background, right? With both law enforcement, military, as well as the IT thing. So I started doing some malware analysis. And at that point in the industry, I was probably one of about 250 people in the world that were actually looking at malware actively. So I ended up looking at malware. I ended up going back to school for a graduate degree, which I got in information assurance. I basically then kind of did the tour. I went from, I was at Wachovia. I went from Wachovia to NetWitness, which is a small startup at the time. NetWitness was acquired by RSA. RSA was acquired by EMC. EMC was acquired by Dell. And then I went to Bank of America and now I'm back to LastPass. So I kind of went the whole gamut of giant enterprise to startup to big technology firm, back to a giant bank and then back to a product company. So yeah, it's been a really interesting tour of duty as far as my career goes.
Yeah, that it's really a different set of situations from these small organizations to the very large ones, obviously. And the malware space has gone through a huge amount of change. And I'm gonna say something that people probably won't love, but as a CTO that sometimes helps manage IT, I have a difficult relationship with antivirus, anti-malware software. It sometimes feels like, is this solving a problem or causing one?
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's funny, early in my career, when I was at NetWitness and doing a lot of field work and meeting with customers, one of the first questions I would ask was, how is your malware problem? And at that point, most people said, oh, we don't have a malware problem. They actually had a malware problem. They just didn't know it, right? So part of that job was like explaining to people, hey, this is what you need to worry about. Now, flash forward a number of years. If you ask people how their malware problem is now, they can give you a very detailed answer because everybody knows about it and everybody's fighting it. It's been really interesting to see how the field has changed over time from that standpoint.
I feel like as I was looking through your resume that your work at RSA, you helped develop their threat intelligence product in a lot of ways. Was there a lot of definition of what a product needs to be that does this type of work for RSA?
Yeah. So, at that point, threat intelligence wasn't like a career field like it is now. It was more something that people just sort of did on the side. And what the work that we were doing at RSA was around the NetWitness product, which if you weren't familiar with it, is a network forensics tool. And it was kind of ahead of its time at that point. And the work we were doing from a threat intel standpoint was typically what they call detection engineering now. So it was like let's look at these current threats and let's figure out how to detect them with this product. And then let's create those detections so we can push them out to employees or to our customers. Mm-hmm. You know, so it gave us the ability to sort of, one, keep track of, you know, what was going on in the world as far as computer security events and incidents go. But then two, you know, help our customers, you know, figure out how they were impacted via this product. So it was like a really interesting growth area for me at the time, because it allowed me to sort of change my thinking a little bit from being very desktop malware analysis focused to being more network, you know, centric and looking at sort of the bigger picture. And that led into, you know, some interesting work, you know, ahead in my career. So yeah, it was a really interesting time.
Yeah. And then if I play it forward at Bank of America, you were almost a consumer of some of these situations. You must have been thinking about, what do I buy for the cyber threat intelligence work at Bank of America? Did you buy your old product at RSA? Was it done?
Right. Yeah. I mean, so what I typically call that is going from the product space to the defender space. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I got the job at the bank, I was a little burned out on doing product stuff and I wanted to do, you know, a little bit more defender stuff. And, you know, I had a pretty significant product experience. So it does give you an advantage when you're in sort of a defender role, because you understand how these product companies work and you understand how they want to sell and maybe why they want to do the things they do and why they talk to you the way they do. So like it's being an intelligence person, it's like human intelligence. I have a little bit of backstory now and it helps me kind of do my job. But, you know, the good thing about that is I had such a wide exposure to just various things, both from, I mean, the early days at Wachovia, the time at NetWitness and RSA with, you know, because I was involved with the RSA breach as well. So, you know, dealing with what they dealt with.
Yeah.
It really gave me this kind of wide viewpoint as to what we need to do and how we need to do things. The threat intel space is really interesting, especially now, because, you know, previously, you know, when I first started doing this work, it was mostly self-taught people, right? It was folks that were in computer security, that were doing malware analysis, they were chasing bad guys, they were using the skills that they had to kind of do this new thing called threat intel. If you look at the space now, like we're getting people that are coming right out of college with a threat intelligence degree. You know, we have a large collection of, you know, both military and government employees that have cyber threat intelligence background from that work. You know, the counterterrorism crew that work, you know, all of the global war on terror, hunting Osama bin Laden kind of stuff. Those guys have transitioned to cyber. So there's a lot of really interesting backgrounds in the space now. And it's really fun to work with those guys and get their perspective, because it's totally different from when we started.
Yeah. As a CEO, I've been a big fan of a veteran hiring myself. In our space, we offer some penetration testing, and it's been really exciting to work with folks with a defense attitude, having been in the military, and then train them up on some of these skill sets. They've got the art of the thing. They just need a little technical skill set, and they really have the passion too. It's worked very well. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the job you're currently at, LastPass, you've joined as the Director of Threat Intelligence, and it sounds like some of the organizations you've joined, there's some scar tissue sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you think about coming into an organization and providing some healing in a way as a threat intelligence, as a leader? Of course, I'm sure that they look to you for some important strategic discussions.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. To use a kind of a cliche thing, I'm kind of a run towards gunfire guy, you know, with the whole like cop and military background.
Yeah.
And, you know, being at both RSA and the bank, I had a tremendous amount of experience of just dealing with incidents day to day, right? Because, you know, the bank being huge and one of the biggest banks in the world, you know, we dealt with incidents on a daily basis for the most part. So, you know, coming into a post-incident role was not a big deal. I was just kind of like, okay, cool. You know, let's fix this, right? I want to help build things and make things better. So, you know, it was able for us, you know, it was cool to be able to come in and sort of start from scratch, right? I basically have an idea of how I want to build something. I can build this program out. And, you know, it's been really great from that standpoint, because there's a ton of buy-in from leadership. I don't know if you've talked to Hoff at all, but Hoff is absolutely brilliant. He really understands the security space. And he understands threat intelligence. So there's not a whole lot of selling that has to be done. He just, you know, trusts me to go out and do the things I need to do to, you know, to help the company be better at security. And
yeah,
and I've hired some good guys. And yeah, it's just a really great experience. And one of the reasons I left was because I just wanted to build something and sort of get back into the product space and kind of understand and help people solve their security problems. So yeah, it's been great.
That's a great solution. Of course, I do remember the days when I used to reuse passwords a long time ago. And mm-hmm. And it's helped a lot. And then I think certainly part of our own security controls in our operation exist around how to share information around access to systems in an effective way that we can control. And we look to systems like LastPass to help us solve those problems. A lot of times we talk to security leaders and organizations and they describe for us there's a business acumen, a communication aspect of the work, as well as a deep technical aspect of the work. Do you feel like that's true for threat intelligence?
Yeah, for sure. One of the things that I love about working in the CTI space is that it's like something new every day. One day I might be talking to the CEO about something. The very next day I might be, you know, in the weeds with the detection engineers trying to figure something out. And then everything in between. And like right now it's been a huge, you know, we're on this sort of marketing tour. So I've been doing a lot of these kind of podcasts and public speaking and, you know, speaking to various people about kind of what we're doing. But yeah, you know, it's kind of the Wild West. What I typically tell people about threat intel, and it's kind of funny, but it's true. It's tell me everything you know about something you just heard about as quickly as possible. And, you know, as you can imagine, that can be a pretty difficult job, right? Because in many cases, there's some event that happens and I'm like, I have never heard of this technology before. So let me go learn what this technology is. And then I can have an understanding of what this means. So there's a lot of work that occurs like that. And for somebody who loves to learn and is a lifetime learner, I love it because I just get exposed to things all the time. And it's, you know, it's fun to talk about and it's constantly in the news now. You know, I remember the first time the president mentioned cyber in one of his State of the Unions, I was like, hey, we've made it. You know, the president's talking about cyber.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really cool. It's just a fun field. You know, I really consider it to be the best job in cybersecurity.
Is there a way that you metric the work or you want to communicate progress to the leadership team in the organization where threat intelligence is concerned?
Yeah. So the good thing about intelligence work in general is with, you know, the work that the government and the military has done, there is a very well-defined process around how you kind of manage intelligence. At a very simple level, it's figure out what I want to look for the things that I want to look for, write about the things that I want to look, that I've found, you know, publish those things to people that are interested and then get feedback if that's what they want. And it's a big circle, right? So I kind of go through that circle and figure out how things go. And then the main way that we determine what it is that's important that we look for are what we call our priority intelligence requirements.
Okay.
And those are things like, okay, these are the things that are important to the firm from a security standpoint. So things like malware and AI and DDoS and ransomware and, you know, insiders and, you know, that sort of thing. So we have sort of a guide of what to look for when we're doing intelligence work. Because if you don't, you know, approach it like that, it's all over the place, right? How do you know what to look for if you haven't figured that out? You know, so that PIR process is really important. And it's something, you know, people do on various schedules, but we typically do like a year, 6 month cycle of, hey, do we need to add something new? But occasionally, you know, things pop up where we're like, oh, we need to add that today because that's a current event. Like AI is a great example. Like the current, you know, the AI world just suddenly just took off and we started going, oh, we need to start looking, paying closer attention to AI. As far as metrics go, that's also a really great question because metrics for cyber threat intel are difficult, you know, because it's really hard to say, you know, how do you find the value in reading a report about something or understanding some cyber event that's happened in the world? And the way we've done it previously or the way I've done it previously in some jobs is to look at if I publish something, does it cause some sort of positive action in the firm, right? Does the firm fix something? Do they buy a new product? Do they do some training? You know, is there a concrete result of the intel we produce? If I can match those one-to-one, that's amazing, right? And if you do that over time, you know, at the end of, say, a year or so, you can say, oh, look, of the 1,000 things I published, 900 of them drove action. So that's a pretty positive metric.
Oh, yeah.
It can be difficult. A lot of people look at threat intelligence as just indicators, but it's way more than that. So, I mean, I could certainly go, we pushed 10,000 indicators into our detection system, and that's a metric we could check off. How valuable is that? I don't know. I have always preferred to have somebody look at those sort of metrics to try to understand the value they're providing. And that's why I like that. You know, are you using the stuff that I'm giving you to do something good?
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely intriguing. I mean, you can think about that at all different sections of the business, right? Like we could say, we could look at like at a go-to-market work and we're like, oh, we got a ton of leads in the door, but we only closed a small percentage of them. What value was all that data or product utilization metrics, right? Like we built a bunch of features, but they only got utilized to block attacks that weren't really in our vector. There's got to be some scoping to that prioritization list, I guess. helps you scope what you want to prioritize bringing in to the threat intelligence work, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So threat intelligence as a practice, like, is there a size of organization or types of organizations that should think about significantly investing in this? And I think about the rise of the VCISO in a way for like early stage startups. And I'm curious, you know, as you go from like an early stage startup through to a more robust organization, when would you recommend that a company start thinking about threat intelligence as a practice?
If you're going to stand up like sort of a world-class security organization, threat intel should be one of the basis of that. Because, you know, if you look at, you know, there's a big focus from the way that we do security work as well as the industry in general on this intelligence-led security. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's much easier for me to build a robust and accurate security program if I understand what the threat looks like, right? You know, if I'm at a bank and I know that Russian cybercrime is probably the main thing I'm going to have to deal with for my customers, that gives me a whole lot of info on what I need to do to make things safer, you know, make things more secure for my customers.
Right.
You know, the same thing goes for, say, like, you know, a DIB consulting firm. You know, the nation states, you know, the China, Iran, Russia, North Korea folks are typically after the secrets that those guys manage. So I have a very different approach that I might have to take, you know, when I know that my main adversary is one of those, you know, nation state A teams. So, you know, there's a ton of value at any size of any size organization for threat intel. How many resources you pour into it really depends on obviously the size and, you know, scope of your program. You know, in some cases, maybe it's one security guy who does threat intel, you know, as a side job, or, you know, it's one of his duties as the security guy for the company. And then you have like a large bank, you know, my bank team was like 40 people, right?
Right.
Which was huge, right? 40 person threat intel team, which we could do almost anything from an intel standpoint. But yeah, it just depends on, you know, the resources you have and, you know, how you want to deploy those. But yeah, I would recommend that threat intel work be the basis of any security program of any size.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's great. You know, you mentioned AI broadly. I've talked to a number of friends and colleagues. It's certainly a lot of all of our products. And so my first question about AI is not necessarily security, but how's it changing the product suite in the threat intel world? You know, what are you seeing it being useful for as a defender?
Yeah, sure. So AI is one of my like pet projects right now. I've been doing a lot of work with it. You know, we're using it at LastPass for various things. But, you know, one of the things that I found it's really, really good at, and this is like a core threat intelligence role, or core threat intelligence job, is summarization, right? Mm. So if, you know, somebody posts something online that's an article about some intrusion or something, you know, typically as a threat intel analyst, I have to read it, and then I have to figure out what the key points are, and then I have to decide if it you know, matters or not. With the LLMs and some of the, you know, the summarization work they can do, it's really valuable for me to just push that into an LLM, say, give me the top 10 key points of this article. And it kind of, you know, it's a force multiplier allowing me to kind of process things quickly. Now, you know, with the specter of hallucinations and you know, some of the things that AI does, there's certainly a little bit of hand holding that has to be done there, but it's huge as far as the, you know, the ability to process these events much quicker than we have been able to in the past. And then the other thing too is the, what we've seen with LLMs is the coding assistance they can provide, right? You can take, like, I'm not a programmer. I'm, you know, I can hack some Python together and make things work, but I've never been a programmer. With the LLMs, you know, something that would have taken me, you know, a day or two to get working, I can typically get working in 10 minutes because that, you know, one of those things could sort of help me build out what I want. I could say, hey, this is the idea of the tool I want. What can you do, right? And it'll basically write the code for me. And as long as I have a basic understanding, I can put it together and make it work. So that standpoint has been really interesting too. You know, I think from a big picture, you know, there's more work to be done in that space, especially when we start looking at anomaly detection and, you know, some of the pattern recognition stuff that we typically do day to day. You know, I as you well know, like every product now is adding AI. It's funny because I log into a site every day and they're like, use our new AI chat feature, right? So it's like everywhere. So I suspect that it's just going to get better and better, and we're going to see more and more of that. And, you know, some of the ability to process these large data sets in a way that's, you know, much quicker than a human being can, I think is really valuable, and that's going to be huge.
Yeah, I've often banged the drum on my product teams that AI is the new layer. We used to do data, business logic, UI. And now it's a new layer in our stack, and we've got to make room for it in every single product we build. There's no other way around it. We've seen it be really useful in automated assessment and testing of security practices. We've seen it be useful in like knowledge gathering or being able to distribute mm-hmm. knowledge more efficiently like you guys are. I have to imagine that if I were to play the picture forward, you know, as a defender, sometimes the best defense is an offense. And I could see AI being helpful in trying to, you know, intel your own systems in a way very rapidly mm-hmm. before you hit a zero day issue or something that's out in the wild.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, the bad guys are leveraging it too. And I think one of the more significant things that we're seeing right now, as far as the LLMs go, is, you know, historically, if you look at the way that we've detected bad guys, like especially with social engineering, you know, a lot of that detection is around the fact that most of them don't speak English natively. And, you know, the way that they communicate, you go, that's not worded right. The grammar is incorrect there. This is, you know, maybe I need to look a little bit closer at that. The challenge now is these LLMs can sound, you know, exactly like a native English speaker. And, you know, me as a bad guy who doesn't speak English can go, help me write this phishing email. It'll write a very coherent phishing email that sounds just like a native English speaker wrote it and is very convincing. So one, you know, that detection where you were sort of using your thoughts and your brain and, you know, the experiences you've had as a human being dealing with other humans, it's not going to work as well anymore. You know, so that adds a layer of complexity to detecting some of the phishing stuff. You know, I think the next step after that, and you've already seen some talk about this, is the deep fake thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, you've got some AI systems that can create video on demand now. You know, what if I create video of the president saying something wacky, you know, to affect the stock market or what have you, right?
Yeah.
Those sorts of things could certainly happen. And we've seen some people, you know, transferring money because their CEO calls them. And in fact, it wasn't a CEO, it was an AI.
Yeah.
You know, so I think, you know, we'll see some of that too. And then you have the whole like, okay, let's use AI to fight AI. So we're going to have some AI that's like trying to figure out if this email was written by an AI. And it's really hard to foresee how things are going to go. You know, the way I put it before is, you know, we're either going to kind of just, you know, go ahead like we're doing now with the LLMs with this incremental, you know, increase of capability in AI, or we're going to hit AGI and it's going to be, you know, just, we're not going to be able to tell how, you know, it's the singularity. We're not going to be able to see how things are going to go from there. You know, so it's a really interesting time. It's a disruptive technology, and I've always really enjoyed watching the market sort of pivot around disruptive technology. So yeah. It's fun. Fun time to be around.
You know, one thing that struck me, I had an AI product we were building in the past that was around human capital management. And, you know, the rapidity with which we built new models had a lot to do with how we were thinking about the surface area of securitization. There was a discussion at some point where we were like, hey, should we every day be building new models almost live based upon the incoming applicants' data that has been hitting the system? And we decided no, that it was too big a security risk, because injecting data into the model live without any type of quality assurance was too dangerous for us. I don't think we've come to grips on the disruption side of building these types of models with what's going to happen. And the simple one was, like, I was reading the Bazinga thing on, you know, how Reddit data had caused OpenAI to start answering Bazinga to responses. And it happened very quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. The whole, you know, if you look at some of the theoretical AI attacks, you know, one of the things that some of the experts are talking about is injecting bad data into the training models, right? So then when they respond, they, you know, say something that's wrong. I mean, and an example I typically use is, like, if you look at Tesla and the way that the Tesla self-driving is going to work here in the near future, they're in the process of switching over to this AI generated or AI driven, you know, self-driving process. What happens if you inject a bunch of, you know, people running red lights into the AI model? So the AI then thinks, oh, when I see a red light, I should run it. Yeah. Instead of when I see a red light, I should stop.
Yeah.
You know, so that sorts of like data poisoning and making the AI do things you don't want it to is really interesting. Now, very complex attack, obviously, because you have to have a lot of access and a lot of data, but it's interesting to think about where it could go from there.
Yeah. And one thing I wanted to ask you about a little bit is an acronym I've seen you use, TIME, around threat intelligence. Mm-hmm. Could you describe that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, so that's the name that we use at LastPass to describe the team that I run. It's threat intelligence mitigation and escalation. You know, so part of the job is doing the standard threat intelligence work. What's going on in the world, and, you know, what do we need to worry about? There's a certain mitigation aspect where we look at, okay, here's an event that's, you know, that's either occurring right now or incoming, how can we get ahead of it and mitigate it in advance? And then escalation, right? Something has happened and I need to tell somebody about it. So it's a pretty good description of the team. And, you know, I like to joke with the boss that when I get on a plane, I'm a time traveler. And it's pretty fun to be able to joke like that. So
I do sometimes feel like I've lost time in between San Francisco and Atlanta or wherever I had to travel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that trip stinks.
Well, this has been phenomenal. And I've learned a lot about threat intelligence and the value it provides for our organization. One of the things that we wanted to carve out a fair bit of time to chat with you about specifically, we generally like to talk about a breach at Secure Talk. You know, it's an opportunity for all of us to learn and improve how we do work or what's out there. It's not meant to terrify as much as kind of make transparent things that are going on. But specifically, I think we wanted to talk about something a little different, which is the recent LockBit takedown by law enforcement with you, especially since you have this background in law enforcement. And so I saw the article on Wired, that's where it first came my way, that a number of different international law enforcement agencies had gone after LockBit, a prolific ransomware attacker, and I think kind of an interesting organization. Maybe we should start there. Like, what do we know about LockBit?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so what's really interesting, and I like to tell the story of how ransomware became a thing when we talk about any ransomware family.
Yeah.
Because I think it shows sort of how the bad guys think. So, you know, if you look 15, 20 years ago, the Zeus Trojan, which is like one of the original banking Trojans, that was kind of the big deal, right? And I you know, made my career off of Zeus with the Niebuhr botnet stuff, if you've read about that.
Yeah.
But the cyber criminals were like, okay, we're going to put this piece of malware on your machine. And when you log into your bank, we're going to steal your credentials. And then we're going to go, you know, steal your bank account info. And that worked for a good long while, right? It took a good long while for the banks to figure out how to fight that. You know, the banks eventually figured out how to fight it. And the bad guys kind of went back and went, all right, so that worked pretty well. I was getting a bunch of bank credentials. I was getting a bunch of credit cards. What else can we do? And they go, fake AV. You know, let's do fake AV. So then they, you know, they bring the fear element into it. You know, your machine is infected. You need to download this and you need to install it and we'll solve your problem.
Yeah.
So a lot of people did that. Oh, and also you need to pay us $30 to, you know, to get the product. So what they ended up with is access to your machine, your credit card information and $30, right? So they're, you know, sort of leveraging and increasing their ability to do that. And then the bad guy or the good guys, you know, it's this arms race where we got better at detecting the fake AV and it became not as much an issue. And the bad guys kind of went back to the drawing board and they went, okay, so the fear thing worked really well. How else can we leverage this? Let's do ransomware. Let's put this malware on this machine. Let's infect it. Let's encrypt it. And let's make them pay us to get it back. That's worked, right? Ransomware is huge. It's probably the biggest malware threat now. And I think that sequence of events really shows how the bad guys are like opportunistic and entrepreneurial. They tend to kind of look back at the lessons they've learned and go, how can we fix this? You know, how can we move ahead? You know, so if you look at LockBit is like the ultimate example of that, because not only are they doing the ransomware thing, but they've also discovered, like many ransomware groups have, that the data exposure piece is also huge, right? So not only will I infect your machine and, you know, or your environment and get a bunch of ransomware on your machines, but also steal some data and say, all right, you got to pay the ransomware to get those things off your machine, but you also got to pay me or I'm going to release all your data.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting approach. And if you look at LockBit, they're probably we're probably one of the most mature, still are, I guess, one of the most mature ransomware groups. You know, they've got like customer support and, you know, they're able to, you know, sell things and they have a blog site and, you know, it's just a really like very business focused, business oriented, you know, criminal enterprise at that point. The really interesting thing, and this happens a lot with those takedowns, is, you know, you asked about my background in law enforcement and doing takedowns. So I've been involved with a number of these malware takedowns. And back in the day, like a while ago, it was much easier because typically the malware would use, you know, a web server or something for command and control. So as long as you're able to figure out what that web server was, you could just go take that domain down or take the, you know, web server down and then the malware was dead.
Yeah.
Zeus is a great example of that because Zeus went from, you know, functioning in that way and getting taken down enough that they eventually went, all right, we're sick of this. Let's build some peer-to-peer functionality into this malware. So not only did the malware reach out to this command and control server to get info, it also reached out to its peers. So then you take the command and control servers down. As long as you still have access to one of those peers, you can reinvigorate the network, right?
Yeah.
You know, so it got really interesting. And then the next part of that was this whole domain generation algorithm piece, which was, I'm going to have this algorithm that creates domain names on my controller, and then I'm also going to have it on the malware itself. And that malware is going to create a domain that it's going to use for command and control on the fly. I'm going to know what that domain is because I've got the same thing on my side. Mm-hmm. I'm going to register that domain and then we can kind of do the thing, right?
Oh, wow.
And that basically made it very resilient to the takedown efforts because we never knew which domain was coming next. So the way that the good guys approached that is they reverse engineered the malware, reverse engineered the algorithms, and then they were registering those domains ahead of the bad guys to keep them from being able to do command and control. So it's like, you know, very, very complex. And it's a great example of how the bad guys sort of use it as an arms race and they learn from the previous, you know, activity. Like they knew that the domain thing was a takedown risk. So how do we fix that? Let's do domain generation. Let's do peer to peer, et cetera.
Yeah.
The Lockbit takedown is a great example. And one of the things I pointed out was I expect that they'll come back. And what, they were down for a week?
A week.
They were back?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that was largely for, you know, the reasons I said is the feds took the, you know, all the PHP servers down. They had backup somewhere that they were able to pull things back up. They just went, oh yeah, they took it down. Let's pull it back up and you know, keep on going. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting. The takedown thing is tough these days.
Yeah. One of the things I read, you know, Lockbit posted on rebringing up the servers and reading through the documentation, they mentioned how their servers were running PHP, but not all of their backups included PHP. That's an interesting mm-hmm. decision, right? Because you're like, I'm sequestering out certain technologies in my backup methodology because that could get infected for a long period of time. And if I don't have PHP in the fundamental files, I can reload those files on new server versions. And I don't think a lot of large entities think about that. They're like, I have backup. It goes for a certain period of time. I check the box. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, the whole backup thing is like, you know, that's one of the primary ways you should fight the ransomware, right? Is to have your backups and, you know, offline and available to, you know, to, you know, turn your machines back on when they get ransomware. You know, the bad guys take those lessons too. And they go, all right, let's back up our stuff. So if it's taken down, we can sort of stand it back up. And what's super challenging about that is, you know, when you look at a law enforcement effort, like this, you know, it requires so many moving pieces and so many things to happen at the same time. Because if they don't get all those command and control machines at once, as long as one is still active, you know, they can keep the network alive.
Yeah.
You know, so if you look at Microsoft and the Digital Crimes Unit and the way that they're attacking this is, you know, they're doing it legally, right? They're going and saying this entity is infringing on our digital rights or intellectual property, and you know, they're able to use the courts to seize some of the equipment and do those sorts of things. Whereas previously it's largely been just a technical endeavor. But yeah, so many moving parts. And if you miss, and you know, in this day and age, if you miss one piece, you know, the bad guys just go, oh, they missed that one. Let's bring it back up. And that's what we're seeing.
There's this knee-jerk reaction a lot of times when we get a security incident notification that it's a nation state actor. But now I think we're seeing a lot more that these are more groups, but I think it's very muddy, right? Some of these groups may be funded by people that have parallel goals, but they're making their own money. They're independent as they want to be on some level.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you look at like Russia is a good example of this. So, you know, a lot of cybercrime is Eastern European focused, and it has been historically. And, you know, Russia has always had the rule that they sort of turn a blind eye if you don't attack Russia.
Yeah.
They'll protect these guys that are kind of doing that work. And the advantage they have there too is that when, you know, the intelligence agencies in Russia need some specific data, they can often go to these cybercrime operators and go, you know, I need a email address from the Pentagon. Do you have one? And they go, oh, yeah, we got this guy with ransomware. Here you go. Right. So it allows the nation states to sort of be involved, but have that deniability to say, oh no, those were the Romanian cybercrime guys. It wasn't us.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if you look at like North Korea, you know, North Korea is doing work that is very much cybercrime, right? They're very focused on cryptocurrency theft, and that's largely because they can fund their regime with that cryptocurrency, even, you know, with all the sanctions, because it's hard to track and easy to transfer and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, so you definitely have this sort of muddying of the waters and, you know, this bleeding of something that's typically APT that's now in the cybercrime space. The ransomware actors are another great example too, because you've got very competent hacking teams. They're doing cybercrime in a way that historically was only done by the nation state teams, right? Because of the resourcing and stuff that they had.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really interesting. There's a whole different level these days.
And to your point, they run it like a business, right? Like they're selling code. They're selling some of their software that they write to perpetrate the crimes that they're doing via their website on top of the ransomware income that they're generating. They've got hierarchies, they've got reviews, they've got quality assurance. They've got security controls in place, obviously, for resilience. It's really quite intriguing, but it's got to be lucrative enough to build an organization with that kind of, well, robustness. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the underground, the barrier to entry to cybercrime has gotten just lower and lower as time has gone by. You know, back in the day, you had to sort of have some technical knowledge to be able to build malware and do some of this stuff. Nowadays, you go into the underground and go, I need access to this network. Who has access? And some, you know, access broker will be like, oh, I have it here. I can sell it to you. Oh, I need some malware. Who can write me some malware? Oh, I've got it. I'll sell it to you. I tend to equate it to like a swap meet. You know, you walk in and there's a table everywhere and every table selling something different. And you can piece together what you want to do by going to one of these, you know, each one of these tables. So, you know, if I, as a fairly unskilled script kiddie type person, want to go and do cybercrime, I just need to get access to some of these forums and I can buy what I need for the most part.
Yeah. These are always compounding issues, right? Like major issues cascade in a way. There were three or four things had to be in play. I think about the availability of digital currency from a laundering perspective. And without that ability to launder monies in such a way, it would have been hard. You know, it's been hard in the drug wars, for instance, to run the funding up and down the pipe, you know, in an effective manner. But it's so fluid now that you can really launder a lot of money quite quickly, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, coming from the banking world, you know, there's a whole lot of sort of interbank work that occurs when it comes to fraud. You know, if I'm at Bank of America and I go, oh, we just saw this fraud and it went to Wells Fargo, I can call Wells Fargo and be like, hey, this is fraud, please send it back. And, you know, they will. It's not as easy with the crypto space, right? Because that goes off into the blockchain and it's gone, right? They put it through the tumblers and, you know, you never know where it goes. There's still a lot of work being done, you know, tracking crypto thefts and, you know, how they occur and kind of where they end up. And the whole approach of following the money, which is typically how banks, you know, do this sort of fraud stuff, is still there to a certain extent, because at some point they have to monetize it, you know, turn it into physical money and extract it in some way. And typically we can catch them that way. But in a lot of cases with the crypto, it's often to the ether and it's impossible to recover. So yeah, interesting time when it comes to money theft.
Yeah. And we mentioned it, but I just want to pull full circle on this because it surprised me. I had an idea we were going to get on this taping and we were going to talk about how LockBit had been shut down and feather in the cap for law enforcement, but they're back up 5 days later. And I lived in Fulton County for quite a while. We have some court documents that look like they are going to be released fairly soon. It took them 5 days. We didn't skip much of a beat, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that shows how professional that organization is. I mean, they understand how the good guys work. And that is something that we've seen over and over again is, you know, the higher end, higher skilled actors tend to watch the security community to understand, you know, what they're doing and how they can sort of bypass those sorts of things. And like, you know, some of the funnier stuff is like when we were at RSA and we were fighting some malware, we would get the bad guys like writing things in their malware that said, hi, RSA. So when we were reverse engineering, we'd pop it up and there was this message that said, hi, RSA, right? So they're very aware of, you know, what the good guys are doing and in some cases, you know, poking the bear a little bit, but you know, it's what can you do?
What's the Bugs Bunny type cartoon where the wolf and the watchdog clock in and out as they change shifts?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, this has just been a really enlightening conversation for me, Alex. I really appreciate it. I'm glad to learn a lot about what threat intelligence is and how useful it is to organizations and also some of the practices. Really appreciate you helping to talk with us about the state of especially cyber threats around Lockbit and kind of the ongoing arms race that we're watching play out for us right now. And so we'd love to have you back on the podcast someday. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been great. Like I said, I have the best job in cyber and I love talking about this stuff. So always a pleasure.
Well, we wish you best of luck and LastPass, lots of success. I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk again soon.